You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 22nd, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Megan McArdle's Alternate History Writing Workshop, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Ms. McArdle, I have a question.
Well, she doesn't call it alternate history.
No.
Because that's not a good statistics analytical word.
And that's, doesn't she call it something like counterfactual?
Yes. My counterfactual on this, which is a, which is just,
Is that like saying lie? Or is that like saying...
No. It's a word that Kevin Drum and Ezra Klein and Duncan Black and anybody who has spent a lot of time waddling around in the sort of the...
Academia?
The academia economics area and who's an analyst, numeric analyst, likes to sling around. But what they mean is alternate history.
Alternate history, right.
It means, what if this were true?
You're playing what if, yeah.
What if this were true? Well, that's called alternate history. It's called science fiction.
What if Hillary Clinton won instead of Barack Obama? That's what she's writing about this
exactly.
Week. And it was a doozy. This article was a doozy.
Well, my counterfactual is, would Megan McArdle have a job if the Koch brothers were shoe salesmen in Wichita? And the answer is no.
The answer is no.
No, because they gave her her start.
They keep her going.
They keep her going.
I want to read this paragraph from Megan McArdle's article.
Uh-huh.
And where is the article published, actually? Business Weekly or...
Bloomberg View.
Bloomberg View. Okay.
Yes, I will toss you a link.
Thank you.
And this was
really is like she's teaching from the David Brooks textbook on how to punch hippies and rewrite GOP history all at once.
And both sides.
So here we go.
This was given to us by an alert reader.
And thank you very much. We love hearing from you, but we especially love hearing from you when you send us tips of stuff we haven't read yet.
Yeah.
That we're actually going to use in the podcast. So thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. She writes, I think liberals really do not understand emotionally the extent to which the Tea Party was created by the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
No, wait, there's more.
Oh, really? But wait, there's more.
And the feeling that its government was simply steamrolling it. From the Tea Party's perspective, you had an unpopular program that should have died in the same way and for the same reasons. Are you ready for this?
Oh, yeah.
That Social Security privatization did.
Yeah, yeah.
Both sides had bad ideas. George W. Bush had Social Security privatization.
Well, and later in the article...
And Barack Obama and the Affordable Care Act had death panels. No, wait, they didn't have death panels. That was a lie.
Yeah.
They had cutting Medicare. No, that was a lie. They were cut Medicare payments to hospitals, not benefits to seniors. What else? What was the other thing that they were shoving down our throats?
Well,
healthcare for illegal immigrants.
First, let's remember that the article is all about Megan McArdle's expertise on the subject of liberals.
Yes, right.
Because conservatives, everyone from David Brooks to Rush Limbaugh, is an expert on the liberal conspiracy, Mike. If you turn on Rush Limbaugh, very much like the Charlie Pierce Rand Paul 5-minute challenge.
This is Charlie Pierce's thing.
5-minute rule.
If you listen to Rand Paul for 5 minutes.
Four minutes and 59 seconds, he'll make a great deal of sense about marijuana or drones.
Mm-hmm.
And like, wow, this okay. All right, I can agree with this. And then at the 5-minute mark, out comes the crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
every
it's either
time.
Racist crazy or...
Yeah, or lying about
white supremacy
about his
or lying or whatever. But you cannot listen to Rand Paul 5 minutes in a row without a lie or a piece of crazy coming out of his mouth. Yeah.
And his dad's the same way. The Rush Limbaugh rule is you can't listen to Rush Limbaugh for more than 3 minutes without, and it's all about the liberals, my friend. It's all about the liberal conspiracy. It really is all day, every day for the last, get this, quarter of a century. Mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh has been syndicated on American air for a quarter of a century. And for a quarter of a century, these good Germans, these conservatives have been listening to the same people tell them every day. Imagine the millions of hours, millions of people listening to this sermon by this guy who explains liberals to them. And then they turn to Fox News to get the other side of the story, and they hear the same party line.
John is going
to
tell me something different.
So conservatives are always experts on liberals. Mm-hmm. And the liberals they are expert on are the ones they make up.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We talk about conservatives a lot, but we talk about specific ones. We name names. Yeah. That guy over there who said this thing today. But people like Megan McArdle, David Brooks, all the way over to Rush Limbaugh, make up liberals to prop up their arguments. And they're all experts on what liberals really think, what liberals' secret agenda are, what they really believe. And they haven't the slightest fucking clue, but it doesn't matter because they're not talking to us. They're talking to their fellow conservatives.
And they're never going to talk to us directly. No.
So Megan McArdle begins with, I think liberals really
do not understand emotionally.
According to Megan McArdle, liberals tend to write off this anger as racism. As irrational hatred of Barack Obama.
She's right. We do.
But at its root,
she's right. I'm a liberal, Drift Class, and I do tend to write off the Tea Party as racist.
Yeah, pretty much entirely. Mm-hmm. But it's the simple feeling that your country's making a mistake and you can't stop it because the people in charge are ignoring the obvious.
You mean like in Iraq?
Well, that you jumped ahead, I'm afraid, there. Because it wouldn't be a crazy ass conservative/libertarian article unless you make Iraq equivalent to something liberals have done.
Liberal have already done, yes. And what is that thing that liberals have done that's equally bad to getting involved in Iraq?
Well, here's Megan McArdle explaining why her sugar daddies, like the Koch brothers, had nothing to do with this. Yes, a lot of money and energy was poured into the Tea Party by rich backers. Hint, hint. I'm not going to name them, but we know who they are. Mm-hmm. But rich backers cannot create a grassroots campaign unless the underlying passion is there in the voters. And Obama administration created that passion with Obamacare. Attention, Megan McArdle. You're a liar.
Yeah.
You're a complete fucking liar. And the thing is, this is the weird part. It's all on tape. Jon Stewart did a whole show on pacing your rage.
Yeah. Yeah,
about it's been 10 weeks. He did
10
this
weeks 10 after the election and you're already at full throttle rage.
It was
against the tyranny.
It was the tyranny. The awful, awful tyranny. And it was people showing up and waving, and I don't want my country to become communist. Right. That is so sad.
Right.
And it was so transparently a case of them attempting to shift the conversation away from
the failure of the people that they had put in office for 8 years. Yes.
Yeah. And let's not talk about Iraq. Let's talk about the economy that was imploding at the time. Let's not talk about torture or any of that. Let's talk about the black guy who's rolling a communist fascist tyranny down our throats through a variety of things, including Potato Day and a bunch of other shit. We're just going to keep making up. And, you know, Megan McArdle says the Tea Party. So Megan McArdle is making the case that something that happened and documented happened on tape, on film, and well before Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And Obamacare was the Republican alternative, the Heritage Foundation alternative.
To Hillary
Care.
Which was basically expanding Medicaid.
This was not the... Yeah, and she's
to everybody, yeah.
And again, the whole predicate for this stupid, lying article by a woman who gets paid to do this, paid mm-hmm. rather handsomely to do this, is that her counterfactual is, well, what if Hillary had won? And the country would
she
be
would have wanted to expand Medicaid to anyone who needed health insurance. That was her plan.
Well, she would have had a much more modest plan.
Uh-huh.
And you can't get much more modest than implementing the Republican plan.
Do you remember, Driftglass, after the 2008 election, someone walked around to shopping malls on Black Friday uh-huh. with people waiting in line at Walmart and other mall big box stores in tents and so forth waiting to shop. Uh-huh. And asking them, did you vote for George Bush? Are you a Republican? Did you vote for George Bush twice? And do you want your country back? And there are people just waiting outside to shop saying, yes, yes, I do. And the interviewer said, you can't have it. It was a very funny exchange, but it was definitely people wanting their country back before Obama had been inaugurated.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, the entire history of the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there is no Tea Party.
Yeah, it's aggrieved Republicans.
All it ever has been. If you just flick past the headline,
mm-hmm.
this is an article about what if Hillary had won. But it's not. It has nothing to do with whether Hillary had won or not. This article is about how awful liberals are
mm-hmm.
and how Barack Obama single-handedly launched the Tea Party with his tyrannical, jackbooted institution of Obamacare, and how, as Megan McArdle said, the Tea Party rage was similar to what progressives felt as they watched George Bush push the country into a war in Iraq. And I don't know how to respond to something that's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's neater, neater both sides. See, it's just like progressives. Progressives were mad over Iraq, and we were mad over Obamacare, so it's like the same thing, which is eerily similar to the lies David Brooks was telling in 2010 when I filmed him at the Hammerschmidt Chapel in Elmhurst, when he was asked a straight-up question, what about your position on Iraq? And what about the failure in Iraq? He glanced over the subject of Iraq and then went right to, but liberals were wrong about the bailout. So pretty much, and it's the reflex. This is the thing to understand about this method. It's not an article. It's not a news broadcast. It's a school of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
a method of writing that they teach conservatives like Megan McArdle, and it comes right out of the David Brooks playbook. You never admit you're wrong. You never admit there's an error. Anything Republicans do, some liberal was just as bad somewhere. Obamacare was just as bad, made people just as mad as Iraq. Except, of course, Barack Obama ran on Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
He ran on health care reform. And he instituted the weakest, most Republican, most conciliatory version of healthcare he could possibly put across and was blocked every inch of the way. George Bush lied us into a war. George Bush should be in prison today for treason. But he's not. He's painting little pictures in Texas. But George Bush lied us into a war. He instituted a torture regime. And I'm sorry, liberals never sabotaged this country by shutting the government down. Liberals never unleashed a tide of congressional witch hunts because they didn't like the president of the United States. And this is, if you skip a little bit ahead in the article, Megan McArdle has a huge problem because she has to explain to her listeners or to her readers how this thing called the Tea Party just sprang spontaneously into existence the minute Obamacare was implemented,
mm-hmm.
which means she needs to pretend that the Clinton administration never happened.
Right.
Because the entire Clinton administration was a rehearsal for the Obama administration. It was the same crackpot right-wing fascists. It was the same brain-dead meatheads screaming for blood. It was the same pack of lies. Vince Foster was murdered. Bill Clinton was a drug dealer, on and on and on, leading up to his impeachment. She had to pretend that that never happened, or it was somehow inconsequential or trivial, because and she does all that by squeezing the entire Clinton administration. And Hillary is the subject of her article. So how does she filter Hillary into this argument? And it's very simple. She says that's not to say Republicans would have somehow been all kissy-kissy with Clinton. They weren't very nice to her husband, after all. And that's it. She just tosses the entire Clinton administration away with, you know, they weren't very nice.
And doily on her lap, as she's drinking her tea, slips to the floor. Oops.
Oops. No, they impeached him. Megan, yeah. Impeached him because slandering and destroying Democratic presidents is what people like, which is what Republicans do, Megan. That's what you people do. That is your seminal characteristic. So the entire predicate for this article is so fallacious and so stupid and so nakedly fraudulent that it could only be described as Brooksian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As I wrote last week on my blog, there's a long line of people waiting to take over David Brooks's job, learning from the master.
Mm-hmm.
It's a style of writing.
Yeah.
That style of writing is lie about history, lie about the history of conservatism, lie about the history of republicanism, lie about hippies, and scream both sides whenever anything goes wrong. And she has mastered the technique.
She has. I find it interesting to see someone so clearly take a step-by-step method and apply it.
Yeah.
In that way. As a writer. I mean, you know, we practice with different genres. We write. I mean, I don't know. You've been through writer's workshops. I've been through writer's workshops where you're supposed to write in the other gender.
Yes.
You know, for two pages. Write as if you are another gender.
Write a parody of a Kafka story.
Right. Exactly. Write a parody of as if a spaceship has landed, right? And there's all the kinds of exercises you can do. But writing as if you have already gotten David Brooks's job at the New York Times
is remarkable.
It is. It really is.
And this is a danger that people run into. I remember a blurb from Stephen King in one of Harlan Ellison's books. And he says, I can't read Harlan Ellison when I'm about to write because it's like an onion next to the milk. I start to, every time I read him, I start to write like him.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and there are certain writers who I just naturally, I write like Raymond Carver when I read too much Raymond Carver.
Yeah.
And writing as a bad imitation of Raymond Carver is not a good thing. It's something you should give up in your 20s.
Can I go back to one thing you said, though, and just comment sure. that I hope that a historian like Rick Perlstein or someone who has incredible grasp of detail and will not get bored with a very intense topic will write about the history of how the Affordable Care Act passed.
Yeah.
Because that would be... it was an exercise in, sausage making, in giving things to specific Congress people, which then stopped once Boehner took over. Once right. Republicans took over in 2010, they stopped earmarks. They stopped giving away sugar to people in exchange for votes, and the whole thing fell apart. Mm-hmm. But Pelosi had people by the short hairs because she could say, no, we'll put a health care center in your district.
Right.
We'll write a check so that your, whatever, Medicaid center gets this money, and you'll be able to take a big cardboard check and a ribbon cutting to your district and put it in your newsletter.
Yep.
And all you have to do is vote for this bill. It's in there. And mm-hmm. it really was sausage making and how you get something done. And Pelosi, there's a lot of things I don't like about her, but she knew how to get legislation passed in the mm-hmm. old Johnson way of, I'm going to get this done. Here's what you'll get if you give me this.
Well, and the old Johnson way was have overwhelming majorities in both houses.
Well, yeah, that's true. But he also forced a lot of congressmen to vote for civil rights who didn't want to do it.
He sure did.
So
Barack Obama had much narrower margins.
Yeah.
Scott Brown was elected no margin.
Yeah.
and so he got through what he could get through when he got it through. And it was passed by Congress, signed by the president, approved by the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And this is something that he ran on. And the only thing I heard from the Tea Party as part of their rampage against all things Kenyan president
mm-hmm.
was their obsession with death panels.
It was
the only part of the Affordable Care Act they cared about.
Well, and the cuts, the quote unquote cuts to Medicare. And how it was being forced down our throats, socialized medicine, and we were going to become Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we once again find that the Bush off machine, the grand plan to rebrand the same tired, racist, lunatic base that they've been building for 40 years, slap a new coat of paint on it, is a cause that Megan McArdle has taken up about 4 years too late. And it is pure Brooksian revisionism to just pretend the past never happened and pretend nobody can look stuff up. Nobody can check you on this stuff because I say so. And David Brooks was actually up to those tricks this week.
He was last week as well. Let's transition to that. You wrote about this in your blog this week.
I did. I
have three things that you wrote about him. Number one is he is hoping that there is somebody in his paper. I hope there is somebody in my paper investigating why the militarization happened of the police force.
This is Ferguson.
Ferguson.
Yeah.
Were there contracts involved? Somebody was making a lot of money selling this equipment to police forces. Now, he's asking about his own paper at which he has interns that have telephones that could actually find out from the editors, is anyone doing this?
Yeah. Oh, he
and
he
yet.
And this is not the first time. This is at least the second time within the last couple of months
mm-hmm.
that David Brooks has settled on a cause which actually moves him to write with some degree of anger or mm-hmm. speak with some degree of anger. The first one was Ted Cruz.
Yes.
He was terrified that Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin were destroying his Republican Party.
Yeah.
And they're ruining it. And he was just begging for someone of stature within the conservative movement to step up and take on Ted Cruz. And take him down a few pegs and really, stand up to him for God's sakes. And
I thought that David Brooks had a platform at which he could do that.
Yeah, that's the thing. David Brooks is talking about what David Brooks should be doing. David Brooks has a job. What's painfully obvious is that David Brooks can never be fired. It doesn't. He could just wipe his ass with a piece of paper and turn it in for the next 3 years, and whoever the hell decided he's a good addition to the New York Times crew wouldn't bother to read it, much less find it appalling. So David Brooks has a job from which he can never be fired. And as he revealed in a couple of interviews, they don't even review his work. He's never been through a performance evaluation. He's never had his work looked at. He and the other op-ed writers have a blank check. They can fly wherever they want. They can write about whenever they want. They can do whatever they want. They can take off as much time as they want. David Brooks is on vacation now. He was on vacation a month ago. A couple months before that, he was on book leave. It's the best fucking job in the world.
Yep.
And you can write about anything you want. And all the articles about David Brooks whinging about how hard it is to write 800 words twice a week and he has these piles of paper that he has to go through is such a painfully obvious example of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his articles are almost always by numbers, centrist, tired, depleted, trivial claptrap. And he gets to get away with that. And he gets to, you know, whinge about how hard it is. And then he gets to go lecture at Yale about it. So he is the perfect guy. But, of course, he's a coward. And so he's not going to take on Ted Cruz or anybody else because that would require balls. It would require him to stand up and say, this is right and this is wrong and this is good and this is bad. And David Brooks does not have the intestinal fortitude or the spine to ever do that. He's a gutless man. He's a frightened middle-aged white guy who is sitting on a pile of money, and his job is to sip indifferent Chardonnay and tell other people what they should be thinking and what they should be doing, but not him.
Well, what I found really interesting about your writing this week on David Brooks is he not only ran away from his job to go on vacation, but he ran away from every mainline conservative that's sitting in the Republican parlor with him.
Yes.
And he ran away from being called a Republican. So we'll get to that, in a minute.
That was hilarious.
Let's talk about the way he ran away from mainline conservatives and all of the conservative big tent. Let's call it a big tent, Driftglass. Everyone from Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck to David Brooks. David Brooks said on, I believe this is from the NewsHour, is it this
same,
quote?
The same thing, same interview. Yep.
He said, there's a libertarian suspicion of really forceful and violent government. Liberals tend to, I guess, be suspicious of police power, especially against minority communities. But for conservatives, and especially traditional conservatives.
It's true.
There's a community thing going on here.
Uh-huh.
The traditional conservatives, led by a thinker named James Q. Wilson many years ago, was to believe in community policing, getting cops out of cop cars and actually interacting with the locals. So that's the traditional conservative position, that you don't want to erect walls.
Yes. Now this was in service of his both sides scam.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes horribly wrong that David Brooks think is clearly Republican, mm-hmm. clearly conservative, it's vitally important that somehow liberals are equally to blame.
And I think too, Driftglass, if I may be so bold, you're the David Brooks expert.
Yes, I am.
But whenever anything is particularly a white problem.
Oh, yes.
David Brooks' panties get into a real twist where he cannot talk about upper middle class whites and privileged whites and white communities being the problem.
No, it is impossible for him to, because then his neighbors would come and throw things over his fence.
Yeah, yeah.
So he can't talk about those people being the problem or part of the problem. But his constant refrain is that whenever a conservative blows chunks on the Constitution, starts a war or two, fucks up the economy, there's a liberal in there somewhere. There's a hippie in there somewhere who's equally to blame for everything somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the constant refrain of David Brooks. That is the leitmotif that goes through all of his work. However, if something really offends him, if something is horribly offensive to his sensibility, it is equally, I'd say congruently true that everybody must agree this is a terrible thing, because wouldn't it be awful if what happened in Ferguson were to come down to a split between basically liberals being right and conservatives being racist assholes?
Yeah.
That would be horrible. So it is important for David Brooks to say, and I'm quoting him now, as for the larger political thing, it's almost unanimous. You look across left, right, and center. People think it's overreacting what happened in the nights subsequently. And that's when he goes into the libertarian suspicion and so forth. But it's really important to him to say, left, center, and right, everyone agrees this was horrible. This was awful. And the way he makes that formula work, the way he makes that equation add up, is by removing actual conservatives from it and substituting an almost non-existent exotic species called traditional conservatives.
Yeah.
And there's one that I know of, and his name is David Brooks. But pretty much across the board, actual conservatives, actual Republicans, have been monumentally assholish about this whole thing.
A lot of them have.
And if you listen to conservative talk radio, which is where is the mother's milk of the conservative movement, it is just abominable.
And we could give you dozens and dozens of examples, but if you're listening to this podcast, you've read them.
And you don't.
I mean, they're all over social media. But you don't need us to do that again. Yeah.
It is absolutely imperative to David Brooks's the fantasy world that he lives in that there does not exist this conservative slash Republican movement that is somehow at odds with the one he made up in his imagination.
Well, so to pick a perfect example, there is no Clive and Bundy in this picture. There is no old white guy stealing from the government and wanting to talk to you about the Negro in his movement.
No.
No, Clive and Bundy's sitting right next to you, dude. Here he is. He's in your party.
And there certainly are no Klansmen dressed up in camo pointing sniper rifles at cops.
And, raising money for cops that have murdered somebody. Yes.
No, this is the Clive and Bundy ranch.
Clive
and Bundy, you had, in Ferguson, you had an unarmed African-American youth. I don't know what the interaction was between the cop, but one of them was unarmed and one of them wasn't. And on the Bundy ranch, you had people strapped. They had assault weapons, they had pistols, and you had snipers who were there to support Clive and Bundy, pointing guns at police officers. Tell me that if it had been a black person with a sniper rifle, a black person with an AK-47, a black person with a pistol, a black person with some Skittles, the cops would not have mowed them down.
Mm-hmm.
But it was white people. It was racist white people supporting a lunatic named Clive and Bundy, who was a hero on Fox News. That circus, that scenario cannot exist in David Brooks's universe.
Yeah.
So his solution is he just pretends it doesn't.
Yeah.
That never happened.
And I don't want to run out of time before we talk about the final David Brooks abomination.
Yeah,
which,
go ahead.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
He's talking with Ruth Marcus, who is, innocuous at this point. She's on PBS instead of
Mark Shield.
Who we always called Lucky back in my house in Belmont, Massachusetts. Get lucky. Okay. And so Ruth Marcus and David Brooks are talking about libertarianism versus republicanism.
Right.
And Ruth Marcus says, so I think to that extent there is a blurring of a kind of liberal and libertarian lines. It's a piece of very interesting strain within the party. And I think you are a bit underselling it, David, because there is this tough on crime aspect to your party. In other words, there's this tough on crime, anti-black aspect that she leaves out to your party. Now, she really had the bad taste, as you wrote, to remind the audience that the Republican Party is, in fact, David Brooks's party. And he got really uncomfortable. Was it my party?
Yeah, David Brooks says, my party?
My party? And there's this laughter. And they said, who are you calling we, Kemosabe?
And Ruth Marcus immediately says,
I'm sorry, I'll take that back.
I'll take that back.
But we can hug it out, he says. We'll hug it out. It's okay.
It was this moment, this very, very uncomfortable moment where someone forgot the rules.
Yeah.
And the rules are you never point out that David Brooks is a conservative and a conservative Republican.
You never point out that he is one with the Clive and Bundys of this world in terms of politics.
You're never supposed to point that out because that breaks the rules. And this is part of a larger narrative that we talk about what it's like to be a liberal in America. It really does remind me, especially when you flip on the television, you see that the media is dominated by people like David Brooks. Mm-hmm. It's like being the competent manager or the competent division in a totally dysfunctional organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can see what the problem is.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what the problem is. Yep. But you're never allowed to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird. I mean, it's funny, and I laugh at it, and I write about it, and I make fun of it. Mm-hmm. But it really is weird that you're not allowed to point to David Brooks and say, dude, that's the problem. You're the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder, what sort of dirt does he have on people? What cabal of really awful people are there running these shows, running these networks, that make it a rule that there's this one subject you're never allowed to talk about? And that one subject is the only subject we should be talking about.
Right. Well, it's like having Grandpa at your Thanksgiving dinner, and Grandpa was in the Klan back in the 50s. Everybody knows it, and everybody knows that everything that comes out of Grandpa's mouth is racist and comes from those days when he probably threw some bodies in the river.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to talk about it because Grandpa's now 93. And I think the problem is that in this Washington bubble,
mm-hmm.
David Brooks is known as a collegial, nice guy.
Yeah.
Who's good for a quote,
sure.
Good for a blurb on the back of your book.
Sure.
Good for buying you coffee, you know, or buying you a drink. And he's somebody that's nice to know because he works for the Times. And if you need something, you can... he'll give you the number of his intern and maybe you can get something. And it's just all, what did you call it? What that wonderful term you used last week about Hannity, taint lathing?
Yeah, it is.
We got a lot of positive comments about that.
It's weird to see it from the outside.
It is.
The other analogy that we've used before is being the honest one in a dysfunctional alcoholic family.
Yeah, yeah.
Where dad's a drunk. And everyone knows dad's a drunk. Dad passes out in the front yard. Dad throws up on his shoes. Dad wrecks the car. Dad beats mom, or mom beats dad, depending on, you know, what happened in your home. And yet, no one's allowed to talk about it.
Right.
You know, and after the horrible night of drinking and smashing and horrible columns about Ferguson and the horrible Megan McArdle disaster, the next morning, mom just says, everybody wants pancakes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, sure, I'd like to talk about the horrible thing dad did last night. Dad didn't do anything wrong. Everything's fine.
He's just very tired.
If that were the one time that happened, you know, everybody screws up once, but it's every night. It's every time you turn on television, every time one of these people gets in front of a microphone, it's the same David Brooks school of lying your ass off. And it's past funny, and it's past exhausting, and they just smother you with this suffocating blanket of never ending. And behind it, I just know behind it, they're just laughing their ass off because they're not accountable to anyone. David Brooks is never going to get fired for being a liar. Megan McArdle is only going to go up in her career, only going to rise through her career. And we can sit outside like good liberals and look and point and watch and look in horror and be right the whole time. The fact is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because whoever is deciding, you know, who gets a career in media and how fast and far they rise only wants to hear Megan McArdle's story.
Well, and that was the point that I wanted to make as we switch into the topic of Ferguson.
Yeah, yeah.
It has occurred to me that we are living on the right through an age of Tinkerbell politics. And what I mean by that is there are boots on the ground in the conservative movement that have been trained. And we talked about 10 years ago, the reality-based community. You know, we make our own reality. But that has really taken off on the right, that if you believe hard enough that Plan B contraceptives are abortion, if you believe hard enough that tax cuts create revenue, if you believe hard enough that George W. Bush was a good Christian man mm-hmm. who did what was best for the country, then that's true. If you believe that, no, the Negroes are really just killing other Negroes, and until mm-hmm. that stops, we don't have any responsibility to anybody. Those people have to take responsibility for themselves. If you believe that hard enough, it's true. If you believe Jesus rode a dinosaur hard enough, that makes it true. No, it doesn't.
Well, and I
go ahead.
It doesn't affect you or me if someone wants to believe in giant turtles that on which the earth rests
mm-hmm.
or extraterrestrials or anything else. It doesn't affect us in any way until it becomes a matter of public policy.
Exactly. And the Tinkerbell policy is what when it evolves into a Supreme Court decision,
exactly.
then it matters. So I think we need, as liberals, to be really clear that you are this politeness. And I do think that a lot of what allows David Brooks to get away with what he gets away with is just we're polite.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to be polite with things that aren't true. And I'm getting to the point in my own discourse. I noticed on Crooks and Liars today, a pastor in St. Louis stood before his, and it was a, they call it a predominantly white church, Driftglass. I guess that means that if an African-American were to walk in the door, they wouldn't kick him out. But the white pastor of this church stood in front of the church and said, I better never, ever hear a member of this congregation call another human being an animal, ever. That's how he opened his sermon.
Yeah.
He'd read it on Facebook.
Yeah.
He'd read it from one of his members.
Yep.
He'd seen it in writing. And if you're not going to stand up, I mean, and you could hear a pin drop in that church because everybody knew who the people were who were saying in St. Louis, you know, I'm only 6 miles from those people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you're only 6 miles from those people. And I had it out. I wasn't angry, and I'm not angry at her, but I have a friend in high school that lives in suburban St. Louis, and she's on Facebook. And she is wanting the violence to stop, which is, you know, if you live close by to violence and you want it to stop, I understand that.
Sure.
But someone, a couple of people, one of whom I know from high school and someone I don't know, both said, I pray that everything settles down. I pray that everything, you're safe, and on and on. And, you know, you're only 7 miles away and so forth. Well, her community is 63.2% white. 7 miles away, Ferguson is 67.4% African American.
Mm-hmm.
And the state legislature in Missouri is 93% white.
Yeah.
So I thought about it carefully, and I wrote on Facebook, and then I deleted, and then I wrote, and then I deleted. Have you you've written like that before? You're like, okay, I'm saying too much. I'm not saying
well,
but
I never write on Facebook. So
well, but no. You write, and
I do, and I have revised.
And you write for publication, and you have to revise to for your audience. And I didn't want to attack somebody that I didn't know who was simply saying that she wanted this friend of mine, this mutual friend of ours, to be safe, and she wanted their children to be safe. Mm-hmm. And she said, I hope it won't spill over. That was the comment. And I wrote back and said, and this is what I wrote. It won't spill over. 7 miles might as well be 7,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Since those of us who live in predominantly white neighborhoods don't have to worry about police riots. Tanks rolling down our streets, lobbing tear gas into our front yards for 10 days. Do you think the 93% white Missouri legislature would allow that to happen?
No.
Don't get me started about whether I'm afraid my white, unarmed teenage son will get shot in broad daylight and his body lay on the sidewalk for 6 hours. Most of us whites, including me, live in a safe little isolated bubble.
Yeah.
White supremacy and privilege have been a cancer on this country long enough. But it won't change until black people register, vote, and get involved in local government. And we know that there was 12% turnout in Ferguson, so that has to change.
Uh-huh.
Don't get me started about voter ID and those mofos. I typed a bunch of symbols on Facebook. Uh-huh. I don't want to offend anybody. In North Carolina, I have typed this much without swearing already.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, and seriously, if it was my son being buried with 6 bullet holes in his body, I would not want it to quiet down. No justice, no peace.
Yep.
And of course, then you hear a pin drop. Well, Francis, I agree with you. Yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Whereas, you know, 5 posts up the list, they were worried about all these looters. You know, I don't want my children to see looters on the TV.
Yeah.
And those people and those looters, you know.
Yeah, that's very sad.
Yeah, that's very sad. And it makes me feel unsafe because I'm 7 miles away. You're a million miles away.
Right.
You are a million miles away.
Mm-hmm.
We got a letter from an African-American listener to our podcast. Thank you very much for writing in. And she wrote to us and said,
and you made clear that we have permissions.
And she wrote me back and I asked her if I could read this little bit. And she said, oh, sure.
Uh-huh.
I live in New Jersey. Okay, this is not. We didn't talk about this last week. Missouri.
Where my people are from.
Yeah, where your people are from. Uh-huh. You know what side they were on in the Civil War?
I do, but please.
Both sides.
Yeah, they were on both sides.
They were on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
They sent soldiers to both sides.
A chunk of my relatives avoided service in the Confederate Army by crossing the Mississippi River at
night. Isn't that interesting?
Ahead of the press gang.
Yep.
So, you
yep.
know.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they were Irish.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Scotch Irish.
Scotch Irish.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were there any moonshine cans in your background?
Oh, God, yes. There were horse thieves in my background. I have a long and glorious history of hillbilly criminality in my family. And that, which makes it all the more ironic, the people who were saved by government programs, were saved by strong unions, were
you
saved by
that
FDR.
At dinner. We were talking at dinner about the New Deal.
We're saved.
Your grandfather built a dam and it put food on his table. During a time when nobody had anything. All right, we're going to get back to this letter.
Let me just finish that. The irony being that those people now don't understand why anybody wants to be a member of a union and hate government.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they have completely forgotten that they are alive because of an active, caring federal government and because of strong labor unions.
Yep.
Anyway, that's just my little aside.
So our African-American listener wrote in and said, I live in New Jersey. Okay, that's not a Confederate or both sides state.
No.
Around the corner from my house, a man flies not one but two giant Confederate flags. Two. And that isn't what bothers me. What bothers me is that he is comfortable to do so.
Mm-hmm.
There are no angry neighbors telling him to take it down. No press or media asking what his problem is. I suspect it's because the neighborhood is 99% white. But would a large swastika fly in a non-Jewish neighborhood?
Yep.
I don't think so.
It's the American swastika. I mean, it really is.
It is the American swastika. And it is not a part of our heritage that we should be proud of.
No. And it's designed on purpose to madden and humiliate people. Certain people. Black people.
Yes.
That's what it is. That's why it's there.
And it was brought out from the attic in the 60s and the 50s.
Well, 50s and 60s and sewn back into some flags specifically to tell integration.
Federal government, the integrationists in the federal government that we're not going to go along with integration.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's its heritage. That is what it stands for.
That is your heritage. Yep. So would a large swastika fly in a non-Jewish neighborhood? We all know that is offensive, right? I'm so tired of justifying my hurt to people who should be allies. White people will never get it because they don't want to.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yep.
And it is that simple. And that is my point on Facebook. I do want to add, too, I posted a picture on Open Thread tonight, Thursday night at Crooks and Liars, of an African-American woman in Ferguson holding up a handmade sign that says Negro Spring.
Yeah.
And there's so much hope in her face that and determination.
I remember there was another picture, another woman from several days ago who was holding up a sign saying, I can't believe I have to protest this shit all over again.
Yeah, that's been around a long time.
Just and boy, you know, I wish I could be in solidarity with you in a literal sense. Uh-huh. But I'm a middle-aged white guy, so I never had to protest this stuff. But oh, boy, do I agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, this should all be so far behind us by now.
Yep. It should have been behind us in the 60s. It should have been behind us with Lincoln. And it's just pernicious.
Well, it
needs to stop.
It's a small number of people who are hanging on to it like grim death.
Yep.
And a large number of people who don't want to believe the small group of people are there, but are very happy for their votes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
and their patronage when it comes to New York Times columns. Sure.
And their willingness to help them punch the true enemy, which are always hippies.
Hippies and liberals. Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Chewy, and Chewy is just a wee kitten. But you are never too young to be an Internet Kitty. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Hey, middle child, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
The Internet Kitties would like to welcome the 12th Doctor to Earth and apologize in advance that things are pretty messed up here right now.
Let's think about living. Just think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, I pulled this off of a website called jetpunk.com. Jet as in airplane jet, punk as in punk rock music, jetpunk.com.
Right.
This is a lightning round. 25 clues as to a character in a science fiction movie. And they assume Star Wars is a science fiction movie. Sorry about that. But
liars!
They do. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Lightning round. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Name the character. He phoned home.
E.T.
Never tell him the odds.
Han Solo.
Who's the most famous Wookiee?
Chewbacca.
Use the Force.
Everybody, but including Yoda and
Obi-Wan. Who do they tell to use the Force?
Obi-Wan. Oh, they tell Luke, but it's
Luke,
Obi-Wan.
Luke. Use the Force, Luke. Who's Luke's father?
Everybody knows. It's Uncle Steve, but Darth Vader is, in fact...
spoiler alert, it's Darth Vader. Very short Jedi he is.
Yoda.
Battlestar Galactica pilot or a coffee shop?
Starbucks.
The first aired, A-I-R-E-D, Enterprise captain.
That would have been Captain Pike.
No, Captain Pike was not aired before Captain Kirk.
Yes, he was.
Okay. They say no. They say he was not. That was not aired. The pilot was not aired.
Well, okay. I will take your point, but it was the first shot. But I think you're right.
Aired. No, the question is which Enterprise captain aired first? They made that very specific.
Okay. Then I'm wrong.
It's Kirk.
Fine.
Who is the next generation Enterprise captain?
Jean-Luc Picard. Well, there's several. Don't lie. There's Enterprise C. There's Enterprise from the future, but it's Picard.
Yes. Half Vulcan Starfleet officer.
Which one?
Half Vulcan Starfleet officer.
That would be Mr. Spock.
Hasta la vista, baby.
That would be the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. The newer liquid metal version of a Terminator?
Is that T-1000.
Right. The only survivor in Alien?
Ripley and her cat.
Right. The chosen one in The Matrix?
That would be, do you want the character name or the actor name?
Keanu
Reeves as Neo.
Neo.
Mm-hmm.
The program that fights Neo?
Agent Smith.
Right. Robot who cleans up waste on abandoned Earth.
Wally.
Wally's girlfriend?
Lulu.
Eve.
Eve, okay.
You can bite his shiny metal ass?
That would be Bender.
Yeah. Cyborg who patrols the streets of Detroit.
RoboCop.
The Marine who befriends the Navi of Pandora.
That's that crippled guy that in the wheelchair whose name I don't know.
Jake Sully in Avatar.
Yeah.
He'll never open the pod bay doors.
Hal will never open the pod bay
doors. Yeah, right. The owner of DeLorean time machine?
Doc Brown, and he gave it to Marty.
Who'd he give it to?
Marty
McFly. Mm-hmm. Who's the bully in Back to the Future?
Biff.
Yes, and finally, the Planet of the Apes doctor who must keep humans in check?
Dr. Zaius.
That's right. Oh, you did very well.
Played by Maurice Evans.
You did very well on that one.
Who was Bewitched? Who was in Bewitched? Who was Dora's husband, Maurice?
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. That's it for Science Fiction University. I enjoyed that, but that was fast.
I'm all out of useless knowledge. I'll have to bone up for next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye. Love you.
Love you. Bye.
Excuse me just a minute. No. What? Okay. All right. We have a teenager who wants to drink Mountain Dew at 9:22 at night.
No.
All right. No. He's putting it in the fridge. That's fine. All right.
Yeah. He's a good guy.
He is a good guy. You're a good guy.
Is this live?
Yeah. It's live. You want to say hi?
Hey. What's up?
How's high school going?
It's going well.
Sophomore?
Yeah. This is the unarmed teenage son she talked about.
Yeah. This is the unarmed teenage son that I don't have to worry about getting shot on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And here's youngest child, and she is 10, and she is in fifth grade, right?
Mm-hmm. Hello.
And you're doing a lot of running. You're cross country this year.
For exercise, entertainment, and recreation.
And everything. And friendship.
Yeah.
All right, upstairs. Middle child has to come down if she's still awake. Is she still awake?
Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome, Mom.
Yeah, all right.
Junior dude cracks me up.
Yeah. She swag, by the way. That's the new thing this year.
Swag is the new money, and money was the new cool.
I am swag. I am fab.
Fab and swag. All right. Good night. Yeah. Everybody has to brush their teeth. All right. I'll see you in the morning.
That's because you're a good mom.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'm blowing kisses to everybody.
All right. Everybody upstairs now. Good night.
I am fab. Beast is more fab.
Beast is more fab than swag. All right. Then you.
Okay. So this is how it works. Okay, Mom?
Yeah.
Okay, so I am really swag.
Yeah.
And I'm like okay, like I'm a little bit fab.
Uh-huh.
And then he's like a little bit swag, and he's like super duper fabulous with his long hat, flows in the wind.
Oh, yeah, he does. All right, sleep time now.
Good night.